all know is a cultural script for shut up, let's start now. The other one that's a code, do you hear that, Tate Ministry? The other one that's a code in my college classrooms is you can walk in and say the word okay in a certain way. And that has all of this other implied meaning as well. Okay! That's not just somebody talking to themselves. Students all recognize if they get out their notes and stuff. Well, okay, we're here still talking about intercultural communication. The first two sessions this week talked about what it means to be an American, presuming that you need to know something about your own standpoint in order to be competent with other people, because they're going to see American all over you, even if you don't see it all over yourself. And the more you know about what American, in quotation marks, means to people in other cultures, the more likely you'll be competent in your interactions with those people, because you can anticipate how they're likely to see you. The last three sessions, yesterday's, today's, and tomorrow's, I'll talk about then what to do when these Americans do sort of intercultural contact with other people. And what I'm trying to teach here is a set of navigational skills where it really doesn't matter which culture you're interacting with. All that matters is that you know what sorts of things to look for. You pay attention to areas where there may be a difference. You can come right across here, folks. You don't have to be obscure or hidden about how you get in the room. It has less to do with a particular culture, knowing the foibles of, say, you know, I'm going to Chile, what should I look for? You're not going to learn that here. But you are going to learn, I'm going somewhere else. What are the areas where there are likely to be some differences? And insights from yesterday include thinking about communication styles and thinking about nonverbal repertoire and nonverbal behaviors change. We break communication into verbal and nonverbal communication. The words, of course, but really a lot of culture is negotiated without words. A lot of the things we do with each other, we don't speak. So one of the things we looked at was that cultures really differ in what sorts of things are in their nonverbal repertoire. My Finnish uncle, great-uncle Toivo in New York Mills, Minnesota, I don't think touch, except with cattle, was really part of his nonverbal repertoire. Okay? But I've had other students who had to learn, coming to America, that, you know, the kind of touch they're used to doing in their home culture that's interpreted as innocuous, hi, nice to see you, may be interpreted as something sexual here, and you might want to not do that unless that's your intention. So, you know, what's in your repertoire? First of all, cultures vary in that. Second, cultures vary in their display rules. The example we talked about yesterday was grief and how grief gets shown in different cultures. Palestinian, you've seen Palestinian funerals on television during the Second Intifada here, and people just throwing themselves in their grief at the coffins or at soldiers or whomever, that's appropriate expression of grief. And those people are no more or less sad than a Norwegian man who's just standing very still, you know, beside the grave of someone that he's just lost. It's just a matter of the cultures really differ in how they display things. The reason to know this, of course, is so that you don't misinterpret. You wouldn't go to Norway and say, wow, these people don't feel anything. What a bunch of cold fish. They feel it. They just code it differently. And last, the same activities, the same nonverbal actions, behaviors, can really vary in what they mean for the people of a different culture. They might have a totally random meaning. What does that mean in America? Twitch.
Ransom.
We can invent all kinds of whimsical meanings for this thing. I just made it up. It has no meaning that's shared. Second, you might have sort of an idiosyncratic meaning. Maybe you know something about your spouse that you can interpret a certain nonverbal behavior from a friend of yours or your spouse, and you know what it means coming from them, even though the rest of the culture doesn't actually use that code. You know it. And it's shared between the two of you. Or meaning might be pretty widely shared so that you'd understand how to participate in things. We also talked about how communication styles really differ across cultures, or that they can. And these are some categories of difference, that we are direct versus indirect in our communication. Americans are relatively direct, so sometimes we go to foreign countries or deal with people from foreign cultures and get puzzled by why they can't just tell us what they need. An example given yesterday by John from Ashland, who's not here today, went home. They had a Japanese exchange student, a woman, staying with them, and he just couldn't pin her down about when she was leaving. And it turned out when he finally actually sat her down and said, we have to talk about this, it turned out she was leaving the day after that, you know, for Japan. But it was valuing an indirect style doesn't mean they're incompetent. It means they value an indirect style. And it's important not to misinterpret that. Some people make decisions in a linear fashion. That's what's venerated in the dominant American culture. The faster you stay on task and make a decision, the more confident you are. That's not true universally. Attached versus detached argument styles. Are you really involved when you're arguing? Are you emotionally into it? Or are you just sort of taking a position and working out good ideas? And no one's angry here. That we can differ legitimately there, too. Sometimes cultures value a real elaborate explanation for things versus, say, an exact explanation or a very succinct, like my Uncle Toivo. There was an example given of a Danish man who went to a church performance in Minneapolis, and the couple disagreed about whether he liked it. I would argue that part of that was because the Danish style is very succinct, that he wouldn't emote, he wouldn't say a lot about how he felt about going to this performance. And that's just part of how Danes do things. It doesn't mean he's emotionally incompetent. It's just a different code. Instrumental versus affective. Do we use communication to get things done with each other? Or do we use communication to establish relationships? Which is the most important thing in a given culture? And we can think of culture as an opportunity or culture as this awful thing to avoid. Gosh, wonder where Americans come down on this one. And then we can, this is an interesting and confusing one, that we can think of everybody as needing to be treated the same because that's what's fair. So students who go to a teacher would expect the teacher to honor a certain policy regardless of who the student was. Now you turn it in late, 2 days late, you lose a grade. Okay, and if you hear about one of your classmates who turned it in 2 days late and actually earned an extra grade, you know, you'd be mad about that. But not in all cultures. Some cultures say, hey, you treat all people the same. You apply the same rules to all people. That means you're not seeing people for the individuals that they are. You're treating everyone as if they're really the same, and that's inappropriate. That's incompetent in some cultures. So this is a review. We really just looked at these categories of information as stuff that can vary between cultures and things that you ought to be aware of when you're moving between cultures. And again, cultures aren't just national boundaries. These are things that can differ all between, say, men and women, which is what we'll talk about a lot next week. Are, for example, nonverbal codes, even within American culture, and even within a certain generation, and maybe even across generations, are those different or similar? So again, this series is about how you navigate. We've got a session today on how to do it competently. Tomorrow I want to talk about how you maintain and nurture friendships across boundaries and maybe encourage you to be more willing and able, feel more able to go do those kinds of relationships. I know I'm pretty reluctant to do those myself, which is pretty ironic given what I do. One other insight I wanted to share with you, this is from a few days back, but my assumption here is that we think about culture and we think about communication. I'm just going to write com. But we think about, of course, a people's communication reflects their culture. That I would communicate in a certain way because of the culture to which I belong. It drives my communication. The more radical thing I want you also to believe by the time you leave is that our communication also drives what the culture is. That as we stop communicating in certain ways with each other, those aspects of culture no longer have any force. Culture is something we negotiate with each other in all of our interactions. It's your way of sense-making your way through Holden Village. As you arrive in the village and you want to understand what the culture is, you pay. Your radar is really up with every interaction you have. And you probably talk a little less when you arrive and listen a little more. And then later on, maybe you get a little more animated. But when you start, you just... That person said hi. What does that mean? You're unpacking all of these things and really understanding them. This person just threw flowers in my room. What does that mean? Okay. And you know, you can learn, is it Holden hilarity or is it impending romance or is it both? You know, what does this mean? And that you have to unpack these things one interaction at a time. And in the process of doing that, you're helping negotiate the culture of the place. So communication doesn't just reflect the culture. By participating in interactions with other people, you're helping to shape the culture. Someone asked a couple days ago, well, how is it a place like Holden Village where there's so much turnover, how does it have any consistency to its culture at all? And we talked about culture as this historically shared code of symbols and meanings. So there are some symbols we really associate with Holden, and the symbols outlive the people. So you come in, you start talking about the same old things, dish team. Where else have I heard that phrase? You know, nowhere. That's Holden. So there are some things that just live beyond. Those kinds of things. So I wanted to start with that today. I wanted to leave this on because I want to share with you one insight, and I'm going to ask you to come up with something. again with each other than we can use in interaction. When you're thinking about being competent interculturally, competence isn't a mediocre term. I'm not saying intercultural competence as opposed to intercultural excellence or mediocrity. Competence is a good thing. You know, that's the ceiling. That's what you're going for. It's not that you're just adequate. Now, when we think of competence, sometimes we think, well, that was a competent dinner. You know, that wouldn't be a competent dinner. I came looking for an excellent dinner, but I got a competent one. In intercultural communication, competence is, that's the top. That's what you're after. And some research early on identified four levels of intercultural communication competence, and Howell really focused on how much you're aware of your own interactions with other cultures. That Tori right now, I would say, has unconscious incompetence. Cross-culturally, because kids are not developmentally capable, really, of taking the perspective of other people. That's not something you're developmentally ready to do until you're older. And then, as you start to become aware, you say, ooh, that was stupid, what I just did. Okay, you move to a stage of conscious incompetence. And that just means I suddenly recognize something is wrong here, but I can't quite put my finger on what it is. You know, what, I'm having this interaction, I'm really uncomfortable, I just gave this man $23 for a lump of clay, and I didn't want this lump of clay, and now he's giving me another one, and I'm taking my, what am I doing? Why am I doing one? What's going on? And then you can move to a stage, hopefully, where you're consciously competent, and that means you're aware of all the things you're doing, and it's a very self-conscious time. You know, you say, hi, why did I say hi? You know, you have those kinds of feelings about yourself, and you get this sense of, okay, I have three choices here, the most competent choices. This one, I'll try it out. Hey, it worked. Okay. And that you have this sense of conscious competence. And then Howell argues that once you get this, eventually, you know, the window shade rolls back up again, and it's not this thing that's always in front of your eyes and always occupying your mind. It's like riding a bike. You just have it. You just learn it. But what I'd like to do is ask you to turn to somebody who's near you, someone who is not known to you very well, if that's possible. That may mean you have to move around a little bit. And I want you to see if you can come up with a story where you felt you were participating in some conscious incompetence interculturally, where you were in an interaction with someone and you felt that there was something wrong, something off about it, but that you couldn't quite put your finger on what that offness was. Maybe you did later. Okay, maybe you came up with a good theory later about what was wrong. But if you could just come up with one example of a situation, I prefer it to be one where you felt something was a little off. Okay, not where you noticed the other people, no other person noticing that something was off, but rather you talked about yourself. And see if you can just come up with one. Describe it to the person you wind up sitting with. And we'll borrow a few of these throughout the rest of the hour today. What questions do you have before you try this?
Where we were the incompetent person?
Not that I would ever call you incompetent, but that where
that's
you...
Howell would have called it.
Where you felt this, something's off here, but I can't put my finger on it as it's happening. And you can report one even that you figured out later. Okay, you became consciously competent. Anyway, you thought back about it and said, oh, I talked about his mother. Oh, whoops. Okay, but if it happened at the time. Other questions?
So intercultural?
It'd be great if it was a cultural difference, right?
Okay.
It doesn't have to. It could just be an individual difference, but a cultural would be more interesting. Remembering that cultures are not just nations. Okay. I interacted with a kid culture, for example, before I came down here. Junior high culture was happening around me in the resource room yesterday while I was trying to type a book review I had to write. Junior high culture exploding in the room the whole time. Go ahead. If you're looking for a partner, please go like this and lift your other hands. Ladies and gentlemen, stop your engines. Just wanted to say this isn't the last chance you'll have to talk about this. You'll be talking about it with the large group rather than the small group. And actually, I want to vary from what you may be expecting now and not ask you right now to tell any of these stories. But I want you to hold them for just a minute. You've told a story, so you brought one to mind. You've heard at least one, so you brought someone else's stories to mind. We'll use them in just a bit, but first what I want to do is present to you what I know from reading research and intercultural communication, what makes for a competent communicator. And then what I'd like you to do is, as you look at each of the components of this kind of competence, compare it against the scenario that you just, either the one you just heard or one you just gave in your mind and think, did this have something to do with it? Did this have something to do with it? And when we've gotten through these four pieces of it, I'd like to see what sort of insights you can come up with related to this. So we're going to the land of overheads. Bless you, that was nice. I always feel like a real professor when I use overheads. You know, I felt that way for 18 years.
Oh, no.
I should have leather patches on my elbows to learn to smoke a pipe. Maybe like a bubble pipe.
You have to have a little gray in your beard.
I do have a little gray in my beard. So there are really four components of intercultural competence, as it's generally understood in my discipline. Remember, this is a competence now that's interpersonal in nature. It's the stuff you can do between you and another person, things that help you. The most important piece is, do you want? Okay, if you're not motivated to have contact with another person, your skill level doesn't matter at all. Karen, you were telling me a story before class about your interactions with the man was from Saudi Arabia when you were a student, who was not at all motivated to have any kind of cross-cultural contact, at least in your eyes.
He'd already decided that women were not worth conversation.
Right. And without that motivation, it doesn't matter what sort of skills you have. But if you have that motivation, that's the necessary first step. It's like having an engine in your car, you know. Once you have an engine, you can still go run into a building if you want to, but you know, without an engine, you couldn't even do that. The second sort of thing are several kinds of knowledge that are key to being and feeling interculturally competent. First of all, you need to know, I call it people knowledge, but all this really is knowledge based on empathy. What do you know about humans? Okay, what can you, and I would argue again that kids know less about humans than grown-ups do. And that one of the things that happens as we get older is that we really do learn more subtle things about people, generally about people. Our sense of empathy develops and we become more capable of taking somebody else's perspective. So that's what this is talking about. You have to be motivated and you need to know something about people in general. You need to know your own strengths and weaknesses and how you are often perceived as a communicator. That's different than just knowing how you're often perceived, period. How do people respond to your communication style often? Hey, do you have one of those laughs that comes out all the time that says, I'm not really sure of what I'm saying? And are you aware of that? Are you aware of how that's often interpreted? So that kind of self-knowledge, how your communication is seen. Third, what do you know about particular others? Not just about people in general, but what knowledge do you have about members of the group with which you're communicating? And what do you know about the language? What do you know about the code that you're using to talk about? When Emily gets together with another woman, they set up an appointment to talk. Sometimes they use that word, we just have to get together and talk. And men use that same word, but I think for us it might mean something different. Or we might use a different word to signify that same event. We might say, yeah, we should go fishing sometime. Okay, we should do something together. When really, what the person is saying is, I'd like to talk to you some more. But women would use, you know, different code to get to that same place. So it's more than just language. You have to know code.
When you say, do you include nonverbal stuff in that?
Oh, absolutely. Don't you?
Yep.
Well, we're on the same
side. What did you say, Karen? Is that
the nonverbal things. What do you understand about what people might intend by their nonverbal stuff or what you might convey?
Yep, that's part of the code. You're incompetent if all you know is the language. Hello, very nice to meet you. A third category, beyond motivation and knowledge, is a certain set of attitudes that really come to feed intercultural competence. You're competent to the degree that you can also not only want to and have certain kinds of knowledge, but are, you know, predisposed to act in certain ways. One is if you have a tolerance for ambiguity, people with this particular trait seem to do better across cultural boundaries than people who can't tolerate ambiguity. I need an answer. Okay? You will be less successful if you need an answer than if you can tolerate some question or tolerate some lack of clarity. Second, empathy, again, the capacity to imagine yourself in another role. Can you do that? Are you empathic? If you are, you're more likely to be successful. And third, non-judgmentality. This is my biggest struggle, is not to be judgmental when I'm trying to interpret someone else's behavior that's mysterious to me. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Well, I figure they're probably incompetent or a jerk or they mean me ill. That's my first impulse, which makes me less competent than I could be. But if you can manage to, I'm just giving an example here below, the difference between a descriptive statement, an interpretive one, and an evaluative one. If you can hear the difference between those three, you're more likely to be competent than if you can't hear the difference between the three. A descriptive statement just says, my ride isn't here. Interpretive is, you know, adding some meaning to what's plainly available to the eye. My ride is late. And you value the statement as you tell them what you think of your ride there.
Yeah, but you could use the same words to be a value, right?
So again, you're showing your knowledge of the code.
My ride is late.
Mm-hmm. My ride isn't here. Sure. So back to what Karen said a minute ago, yeah, you need to know the nonverbal aspects of the code as well. And here's the last piece. This is the one that most people want to jump to right away, and really, without the other three pieces, this one doesn't work as well. You can pretend all your life, but you're not going to be as competent, truly, unless you've got these other pieces, the motivation, the knowledge, and the attitudes here, some skills that we know. So if you know some general things about any culture that you would interact with, you'll be better off than if you don't. Okay, that's all A is saying. But B, these are listed as behaviors, but really they're kind of categories of behavior. How do you display respect to a child in America?
Listen.
Crouch down.
Pay attention.
Crouch down. What's pay attention look and sound like?
Listen.
What does that look like? Yeah, show me listening.
Hi!
Okay.
Okay.
How are you today?
So you're looking at me, did you see she leaned forward and you turned toward me, you turned your body toward me? That in this culture, thank you. In this culture, that's a wonderful way. And you said crouch down. What did you say? You said listen also.
Active listening.
Right, okay. So you might ask them some questions. You wouldn't just go. You don't just mouth breathe at the kid, that there's more to it than that. But that we recognize that display of respect is an important category. This might be the most important category in intercultural communication, is knowing what respect looks and sounds like in a given culture. And knowing that you can't just take your own version of showing respect and plunk it down in any culture at all. I saw a photo in the newspaper earlier today. I don't know how many days old this is, because I know his hitting streak ended a while back, but there was I think he's Dominican, Castillo, the guy who had the long hitting streak in baseball this year, being consoled by his Anglo manager, Jeff Torborg, and Torborg's got his hand around his neck, it's kind of pulling him toward him, you know, consoling him in the dugout, and Castillo's looking like, let go of me. But this is not reassuring, this is not, I'm sure he's giving his manager the benefit of the doubt, but that really, that's less competent than figuring out, well, what counts as respect among Dominican players? How do you do that? Interaction management, that means how do you know when it's your turn? Rich, you said something over, I think it was in a meeting yesterday where you talked about, would you say what you were saying again about speaking a second language and how long it takes you to learn to join conversation appropriately? Remember this?
I can't remember.
Oh.
You're talking about Spanish, you said there are all these ways to get into a conversation
that
you don't necessarily learn with the language.
Right.
It's just a little casual stuff.
A little casual, like even think about a phone call and the little words, the little phrases you use to get in and out of a phone call. But also just, you're just with a group of people, you just kind of want to be part of the conversation, that you develop a competency to how to know exactly the right words to kind of slide into a conversation. And when I was learning Spanish and working in the Hispanic community, I didn't know all those little words, and I felt very, very lonely and isolated because I didn't want to make a big mistake and just jump in without knowing the phrases.
Thank you. I had a friend in college who went to Norway, a woman, and when she came back, she said the way she learned to fit in with the Norwegian women was that they would often be sitting and doing something crafty with their hands. These were older women in Norway. She was visiting older relatives, and she said they spend a lot of time just rocking and doing this thing, and somebody might say something, but often nobody would be saying anything, and the woman would go, yeah. They'd just be breathing in and saying, yeah, over and over again. And then this is a way, and as soon as she learned to say that, they sort of smiled at her like, okay. And then, you know, she'd do it tentatively, and you know, they'd look, and it was this, she was figuring out that kind of, how to be part of the group. I have another friend named Milt who teaches in Minnesota, who is really good, well not good, but he's really obvious about how he gets into conversation. If you think of it, you know when it's your turn in a conversation, right? In your own culture, you know, okay, when it's okay to do this. How do you know?
It's like when you play jump rope as a kid and you learn
like to wait for the.
For the.
It's the pause and the invitation. It's a pause. Like a person finishes a sentence or a thought, and then.
But sometimes it can be a pause.
But that's not the same in all cultures.
Right, I'm just asking about this
one. Because Italian cultures, you can just kind of.
Is it rude or not rude to interrupt? I mean, for me, it feels rude when somebody starts talking back at me before I've finished my sentence, and yet that's normal and expected in some kinds of interaction.
And if you
actually wait, you're considered to be wimpy or not fully engaged.
Not worth hearing.
Yeah.
Unless you're willing to engage that way. Chile is a culture that's that way, especially for men. If you wait your turn, you will never be heard because it's not appropriate. You have to exert your masculinity by really forcing your way into a conversation.
That's true with politicians, too.
You bet. Political culture.
They talk the loudest and the fastest.
Or at least pundit culture. Right? Mm-hmm. Pundit culture. Not all politicians, but certainly the ones who are on TV. Yeah. But that's how they get there. Milt is really good at, he just kind of goes like this when he wants to get in a conversation. And if that doesn't work, he'll go, ah. And if that doesn't work, he goes, ah. I think that, you know, just like, he's in the conversation. But then if you recognize that we have all these strategies, sometimes we listen for spaces, sometimes we signal with our eyes that we want in, maybe you start to nod a little more animatedly. Or if you're in a group like this, watch where your head turns. You'll hear somebody take a big breath like Barbara did a minute ago. Barbara went, you know, and it was, you did, and like three heads at least went. But that means, you know, somebody's getting ready to spell some words. So we're good at this in our culture. We recognize the code for the culture in which we participate all the time. But there are other cultures where, you know, there's a space, and Americans especially, we just want to fill that space. Don't want any silence, God forbid. So that's one of the things we can do that's incompetent. One of the things you need to be aware of is how do people within that culture manage their interactions with each other? How do they tell each other without saying, hello, your turn? We don't do that stuff out loud. We do it always in a negotiated, subtle way, and really interactions are among the toughest.
But sometimes you can do it out loud if you ask the person a question.
Of course.
I mean, you can, especially somebody who seems to be struggling in a conversation, or struggling with English, for example,
right?
You can ask an appropriate question that fits with the conversation.
Okay.
As a way of saying, here, I'm making a big space for you. I want you to be part of this.
Sure. And that means you're competent in interaction management. You recognize what's happening. You recognize the person hasn't figured it out yet. And you're going to make a big space for them. And by asking a question, you're signaling to anybody else involved, let's help. This person,
yeah.
And everybody picks up on that without saying, hey, this person's being an idiot about interaction, let's all help her. Okay, I'm going to ask her a question now. Okay, none of this stuff gets spoken, and maybe not even felt, but it's something that clearly happens. Tolerance for ambiguity, that gets expressed in a whole bunch of different ways in different cultures. This is funny to me that it's listed as a skill, but really it is when you think about it. How do you tolerate ambiguity? My daughter Tori asks a lot of questions. She tolerates no ambiguity whatsoever. And it's one of the ways that sometimes sends, you know, kids who can't tolerate a lot of questions, you know, run away to someone else because that's just too hard a work to have to answer all those questions. Empathy also comes with a certain set of behaviors attached in different cultures. How do you be empathic in different cultures? What would be appropriate and what would be inappropriate to do? This one's interesting. Americans especially, we're predisposed to task behavior in our communication. We're very instrumental. We communicate to get things done, especially the dominant masculine culture. Competent communication isn't the warm fuzzy stuff. In fact, warm fuzzy is a pejorative. You know, we're just going to sit around and have warm fuzzies all day, or we're going to get something done. Then, yeah, you're right, you know, is what we say, because that's what we expect people to get together for. But in other cultures, very often, relational talk, finding out about the person, finding out about their family, finding out about the culture is privileged. That's the stuff that is really important and competent to talk about. And that the more instrumental stuff, kind of if you lead with that, that marks you as less competent in many cultures, not all. But enough that this is an important thing to lead with. And last, interaction postures. Just knowing how it is you should approach interaction, not just how you manage your place in it, but how it is that you come to interact with people. What do you bring to that interaction? How do you find yourself in interactions with people? Is it appropriate to strike up an interaction with someone in the grocery checkout line, for example? Do you know that kind of stuff? So these are skills that really matter. Let me share one more with you, and then I want to ask, I'm going to ask you in your mind at least to rank these four for you in terms of what you're best at and what you're least best at in terms of motivation, knowledge, attitude, and these skills. Which do you think come easiest to you, and which is your biggest difficulty? So here's some general advice, too, that you're welcome to consider as you consider that question. One way to think about competence is to think about synchrony. There's a theorist named Irving Goffman who's very clever. He compared life to theater and said that the point of social life is not to drop a line, is to make sure that everything moves along smoothly. So if I'm going along on a trip, or I forget what I'm going to say, people around me don't generally stand up and go, ha-ha! You know, people, when I do that, people will stand up, or people will say, will help, or say, you were talking about, or we do things to help each other, we prompt each other, right? Because the goal of human action, interaction, is to keep it going, to keep it moving. And so one way to think about competence is to think about synchrony, keeping things in sync, if you don't mind the boy band reference, that's not what I'm talking about. But that you have this sense of, you understand how to help the people around you in the same way that they understand how to help you keep things moving. Okay, keep the interaction flowing so that nobody loses face, nobody's uncomfortable, everything works out. Nobody loses face except on purpose. You know, you can have competent interactions where you're trying to shame someone. And if you do it correctly, great, you're competent. But nobody should be shamed unwittingly. So you can think of competence as synchrony. If you can monitor how you feel about differences in nonverbal behaviors. I had this man stand up yesterday and stand really close to me, and neither of us, I think, is it fair to say you were uncomfortable with that? I was uncomfortable as well, and I was the one who engineered that amount of personal space. In fact, you appear even to be injured today as a result.
Yes,
I
am.
But one way to add to your competence is to be aware of your own emotional responses as they're happening and say, instead of saying, I don't like this person, you can say, you know, I'm uncomfortable standing this close to this person. Should I be uncomfortable? Okay, if you can monitor that, you'll be more comfortable or competent than if you can't monitor that. Second, pay attention to the culture's general tendencies. That's, again, a reminder that other cultures are as diverse as our own. You know something about Malaysian culture, that doesn't mean you know something about, you know, anything really significant about any particular Malaysian person. They're all over the map. But it helps to know what their general tendencies are. It also helps to be tentative if you can as you interpret behavior. Be willing to change your mind about the meaning that you think is attached to something that's going on. And look actively. When I say look for exceptions, this means really look for them. If you think you've got some sort of law or norm worked out of how people interact with each other, see if you can find exceptions. See if you can find negative cases where it's not true. And that'll help you know whether you've got it right or not. And last year, I really applaud these. We have the five students from Japan here that are doing this. You know, find and use opportunities to practice your observation, evaluation, and behavioral adaptations. Well, how about we go to, let's go to a remote village in another country. And let's just try it. Okay. So, you know, they're really working hard at this piece here. So when you think about it, I don't want you to talk about this with each other necessarily, but with the larger group, which of these things do you think you are best at? Do you think, is motivation your strength? I really want to get together with other people. Is it knowledge? Do you think you really have a lot of good self-knowledge, knowledge of people in general in particular cultures? Do you think you have some of the attitudes that are associated with being competent? And maybe do you think a lot of these skills perhaps come easily for you? If you're willing to talk about this for just a couple minutes, I'm interested. Meanwhile, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think I'm motivated because I like people. Mm-hmm. And so
you're not worried about the rest of it because you've got the engine in the car.
Not so much so. Well, I watch their reaction, which makes me slow down or continue. What they look like. So, what do you want? Or something like that.
Well, they're trying to help. You know, they're trying to keep the conversation going. They don't want it just to dead end. Thank you. Some of the others, what do you see yourselves as especially good at? Well, how many of you would agree? How many of you see yourselves as motivated to do this? Okay, as a decent strength, all right. What else do you see in yourself now? What strengths do you see? Go ahead, Barbara.
I'm good at observing people's reactions and then adjusting my behavior accordingly.
So knowledge is a strength for you then?
It's not knowledge, it's intuitive. It's picking up on subtle cues.
Okay, so, well, I wonder, are you talking about knowledge, attitudes, or skills then, as you describe yourself? Where do you think your strength is there? What strength do you describe?
It's not knowledge, because it's not, I wouldn't call it anything that I've put in my head, except, it's mostly, it's like I'm good at tuning into someone's radio frequency. You know, so if they're on a certain one, I go, oh yeah, I'm not on that one. Let me go tune it, you know, and then I tune it over there.
Okay, so empathy maybe is strength.
Yeah, it's more of an empathic kind of thing.
I'm so pleased when I get it right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Rich, you had one?
I think the ambiguity one. I have a pretty high tolerance for ambiguity. In fact, kind of enjoy the mystery of life, and so kind of get a kick out of breaking through the fog of not understanding people. So that it intrigues me rather than repels me.
Repels me.
Some of the time.
Mm-hmm. I've had some interesting interactions here at Holden, and the most negative ones I've had over the years have been with people that seem to have very little tolerance for ambiguity. This is a big button for me. Just really hard for me to enjoy talking with real black and white thinkers. But that's a harder piece. One more. Somebody else who has a strength we haven't heard of yet. Go ahead.
I think I have the ability to draw people in conversation, what I take into doing sometimes, like with my own granddaughter. She asked her mother why Grandpa asked so many questions. And she thinks that, or my daughter says to her, because he was a teacher once. And she says, well, he must have not been a very good teacher. Teachers are supposed to give the answer.
Right, not ask the questions. You know, that's still out there. We still struggle with that. You know, when you're being observed in the classroom, as my fellow professor would know, you want to have it be a day where you're doing more telling than asking, because they might think, does he really know anything? Or is he just asking questions?
Don't you think age and experience change the way you deal with people?
Do you?
If you're very, very confident, you could chance you might be more judgmental.
Maybe.
Or if you're older, your opinions get more fixed and you have less tolerance for other people's ideas. Could be. I mean, it doesn't have to happen, but it's...
I'm thinking, especially in terms of these, I think that age really changes our ability to do this, to tolerate ambiguity, to generate empathy for other people, and to recognize judgmentality and try and avoid it. That it's really difficult, I think, I think the younger, especially kids are, the harder these are. And that these are at least abilities that increase as we get older. Whether we exercise them in this direction or not, I think, is a different story.
I guess the more opinions you gather, the less tolerant you are of other people's opinions. You think you've gotten all the answers. I don't listen to somebody else.
Possible. I mean, we did say one of the pieces of intercultural competence has to do with being tentative. What do you find yourself struggling with as you, now, whether you can think theoretically or think of the stories you were telling to partners here, what do you find yourself struggling with? Is it motivation? Is it knowledge? Is it attitudes? Or is it actual things to do? What would you attribute the problem in that scenario to?
Task orientation. I'm wanting to get something done, be instrumental in not giving up on that, managing the relational
side. Okay.
What else? He is hidden agendas.
Yours?
No, other people's hidden agendas. I'm not very skilled. So I'm pretty straightforward and direct. Say what I want as a result, and I don't hide agendas. And I find frequently that to people, hidden agendas are part of part of the game or part of the ways that they want to approach a situation.
That game metaphor wasn't accidental, was it?
The game was not accidental.
No, it feels often like...
Yeah, people, you know, I find out after the fact that it wasn't a game. You know, I mean, that's the way that they approach a situation and the indirectness. And I'm not very skilled at interpreting that.
Okay,
I'm so working on it. So I know that's a weakness, and I need to continually be aware of that.
So you're struggling to understand some of the other meanings encoded along with the message itself.
That's great.
You might think of messages we share with each other as like icons on a computer screen that you could click on them. Right. You know, click on the properties button, you know, and you'd see all the stuff that's in the message there. Aside from just the hi or whatever the word was, you know, there's all this other stuff attached there. And there's a lot there. There's a lot to pay attention to. What are some of the rest of you struggling with around this? In which area do you really think you need to focus? Notice I'm presuming you're all imperfect.
Don't they overlap?
Of course they do.
And so all of them or a little of all of them?
Okay, anything in particular? Mary, right?
Mary. Mm-hmm. No, not in particular.
Joanna?
Well, I can relate to what this man just said. Your name?
Craig.
Okay, what Craig just said. I have a difficulty in conflict resolution in that I want to get right to the heart of the thing and tell a person I hate what you're doing.
Please knock it off now.
Yeah. And I'm not going to go into the story. I shared it already with Karen. It's a long, long story. But the people next door had a kid at age 13 or 14 who was given a dirt bike. And whoa, you know, that just hit all kinds of buttons because he was riding that thing day and night practically. And we were, you know, my anger at this noise just was, you know, to the point where I was becoming ill. And so finally when I was able to approach the father about it, it was just like explosion. And he hasn't talked to me for 25 years.
Oh, he still hasn't talked to you.
That's right. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. This is true. Mm-hmm.
And you still live next door to each other?
Yeah.
Is there still noise from that motorcycle?
Yeah. The motorcycle left, the kid grew up, and we got a county commissioner who Duane talked to and said, hey, we need a noise ordinance out here. He did that as one of the first things on his agenda. So we finally had the law on our hands, on our side. But I know it's a problem I have. When I don't like something, I just want to take care of it right now, and I don't want any mess about it.
One real nice thing about, I'm hearing in a lot of these stories and when I talk to people about intercultural stuff, is that we approach it, most of us, with such great intentions. We really want to do well. We want to support other people. We want to understand them. We want them to understand us. We extend goodwill to them. You know, we do this, and you know, sometimes my goodwill comes to them and just goes bang, you know. But that we approach it with such good intentions, and that really this whole notion of communicative competence is kind of a translation skill. How do I translate my heart into the appropriate messages, the appropriate verbal and nonverbal actions that get done what I want to get done? There are consequences of this for the people who actually enter society. I did that pretty well, didn't I? When you have somebody who's a stranger in a culture, which could be you, of course, we're part of a culture a lot of people happen to visit, but that there are really several outcomes associated with being a stranger, being a new navigator in a culture. One is that you just assimilate. Many people choose this route. They take America as a melting pot. And they say, I will come to America, I will be American, I will learn the language, I will buy the clothing, I will work at McDonald's, I will do whatever. And I will maintain no ties at all with my country of origin, I will assimilate. So that's one way that people often come to be part of a new culture, is just to give up anything else they have. Others are find themselves in something town, Chinatown, you know, Malay town, Thai town. Moving just to an enclave where they don't have to have much interaction with the larger American society, participate in the economy, but not really in the social or political life of the country, except as a block. And that segregation is another way that people can go. Integration is where you would choose to interact with American culture, on a daily basis, but also maintain important pieces of your own culture. And this is really hard in America. We tend to really want people to do this. Okay, assimilate. Do you hear they still speak Spanish in the home? You know, how are their kids ever going to succeed? So, you know, this is a difficult model to pursue. And as members of the dominant culture, it helps to know that this is actually a very healthy model, too. Marginalization is where a lot of individual people often find themselves, is having a feeling of no social or political influence whatsoever, not being part of either an assimilated group or even a segregated group. You've just emigrated, and you're just kind of adrift. We stopped for gas where we were driving. Wasn't here, in case you thought that was the answer. And there were a couple real recent immigrants from somewhere in West Africa just standing at the counter having lottery tickets explained to them. They were very excited about the idea of lottery tickets. And it struck me, you know, here are people just kind of grasping at the obvious handles of American society. You can come here and you could win big, you know, well, I'll try that one out. And some people never get off of those margins. They don't have a culture that they found here when they brought their own. And that often our intercultural, here's the punchline, our intercultural competence has a lot to do with how strangers in our midst, how people in the wilderness actually come to be a part of the culture in which we navigate pretty smoothly. How I interact with individual people can have an effect on whether they feel a need to assimilate, to segregate, to integrate, or to live life on the margin. That interpersonal communication has impacts that are social and political. What?
I think I was daydreaming, but what's the difference between assimilation and integration?
Assimilation is you don't maintain any ties with your native, with the culture from which you came. You just say, I will be you. This one says, no, you know, I've got a lot of heritage I want to keep, but I also want to be American.
Uh-huh. I see the top three as a result, but I don't see marginalization as a result. I see it as a predecessor to the three. It's kind of as a point in time when maybe there's a confusion as to where somebody's going to be, but I don't see it as an end result like I do the other three.
Okay.
Do you see people continually maintain a marginalization role?
I think a lot of it has to do with wealth. So, I mean, I don't think that my communicating with somebody is necessarily going to take them off the margins, but I think communicating with people in certain ways can certainly help keep them there. Just by what I choose to label them and how I choose to interact with them or not.
I work with a group of Russians who are seeking citizenship, older people who have a lot of trouble with English, and it seems to me that they're destined for marginalization unless they were to take ESL.
Because?
Because they could speak the language and they could start talking to people.
Motivation.
Yeah, it's either segregation or marginalization. And America is a culture that really values the ability to speak English. And I think you're right in knowing that. And I bet you push that with them.
Well, we try to speak English. I haven't learned much Russian, I'm sorry to say. Yet.
Yet. You can say no. That's good. You were nodding like you were going to say something.
I was thinking of, I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm very, I also speak Spanish quite a bit, and I have a person comes in, well, I have observed that Hispanic people are often in Portland involved with landscaping. And okay. Landscaping work, okay. And this is fairly new in the last, say, 10 years. And there's, what I've observed is that those Hispanics who do landscaping work, who learn how to speak English, become in the lead job when they are sent out to do a landscaping job. And are the one, and the people who are not in the lead jobs don't speak Spanish, or excuse me, don't speak English. And also do not appear to want to, because I've spent time with them when they've come to my house, and it's been pretty consistent. And the people, so if they choose not to speak English by their own choice, and I think it's motivation a great deal, or fear, then they marginalize themselves from getting other jobs or owning their own pickup and their own landscaping business which that happens for people who speak English or Hispanic.
Nice. It reminds me of a story. Remember when Garrison Keillor married his Danish sweetheart from high school and went to live in Denmark? Garrison Keillor is a radio personality in Minnesota who's broadcast a lot of Prairie Home Companion. And I think he really values his eloquence. He really likes being able to say things. As do many of us. I love his eloquence. I just think he's great at capturing where I grew up. But I remember reading, after he'd been in Denmark for a couple of years, how it felt to be at the dinner table with all these people who knew each other, all these Danish people, and his new spouse, who of course is Danish, and that they were having obviously a wonderful conversation about something in Danish, and then they would dumb down to first grade Dane so they could talk to him. Here's somebody who thinks of himself as articulate and knows how to navigate his own culture and is proud of that, and then just because of a linguistic incompetence is marginalized and feels bad. Much like you're describing the people who are in charge in the gardening units, mm-hmm. Who gets to run things.
So what I do is I don't hire American white companies to do the work, because they send Hispanic English speaking leaders and their workers to do the job and get paid minimum wages. I go and find the Hispanic owner of the business.
So I think we can do to help that are beyond just how you communicate interpersonally. I mean, we're for the last 10 minutes here, we've been grasping kind of a socio-political agenda just to give another reason to why bother learning how to communicate across boundaries. The last thing I want to leave with you today, though, are things that are benefits more to you as a navigator of new cultures. And really, there are three that are supported by research. One is you really get a stronger sense of psychological health. If you are interculturally competent, if you can in fact navigate across boundaries, and you know you can, you are a healthier person psychologically than if you can't, and if you know you can't. So that's one, and that's probably an obvious outcome, is you feel more comfortable around other people. You're less likely to be judgmental and misread somebody's communication to the detriment of all. Second is something I like to call functional fitness, that you're able to navigate. And you recognize the rules for communication, and you pick those up in interaction, so that you become just an aware sort of person. You're good at clicking on the messages that people send you to see what's packed there, and you recognize the important cultural messages that are part of our communication with each other. And last, the sense of intercultural identity, and that means simply you are able to dance. You're able to dance. You're able to act situationally. I find myself here. Okay, here I am. I know some of the questions I should ask myself, and I'm able now to ask myself some of those questions, answer a few of those questions, and I can act situationally in a way that will be competent. I could come into a place like Holden Village and speak with a bunch of strangers one at a time or as a group, and probably not hurt them or shame myself to a great degree. But really, I understand what the situation calls for, and I can respond to the situation. So if you can come away with this motivation to interact with people from other cultures, a certain set of attitudes, a certain set of knowledge, and a certain set of skills, if you have these things with you, the argument from research on the subject is that you are more likely to look like this. You will feel more comfortable with people from other cultures, and you may even seek them out. You will be capable of unpacking the communication messages that you're getting from other people to help you navigate and learn the culture. And you'll be able to operate more situationally, less bound by your own personal traits. You'll be able to respond to what the situation calls for. Now I hope you have several conversations that last for the next 24 hours until I see you again. Thanks for coming. Tomorrow we'll talk about maintaining relationships across boundaries. We're going to talk about the notion of face work, which is a very interesting concept to me.
What's
Facebook?
We won't be here.
What's Facebook?
Yeah.
Your session's in the morning, so
it's
fine.
Oh, yeah,
my session's in the morning tomorrow.
Oh,
it's
9:00, 10 hours. There's
not 24 hours.
What is it, 10:45?
Yeah.
10:45 a.m.
Yeah. Can I add a theological thing to that lesson?
Well, I hope you would.
I really see, an intercultural breakthrough is really part of the coming of the kingdom of God, too. I think that the reading of the Pentecost story in the chapel a couple nights ago, that when people from different cultures understand each other it's really a sign of the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. So that's part of why it's exciting.
I think it's great, and funny, I didn't find that in the social science literature. Why would that be there? And the kingdom of God appears.
They are still benighted.
But totally.
You don't understand it. It's not in language that makes sense.
Thank you.